Tonight on Arena, on TV, we've been watching season two of Poker Face and A Deadly American Marriage and listening to new albums from Counting Crows, Mark Pritchard and Tom York and Varro. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena and you can watch us on rte.ie/arena. Starting with our TV reviews this evening, Poker Face returns for its highly anticipated second season on Sky. Natasha Lyonne is back as Charlie Cale, former casino worker with an uncanny ability to detect lies. This season follows her as she hits the road in her Plymouth Barracuda, encountering a fresh cast of characters and solving unique crimes at every stop. There are lots of guest stars here, including Cynthia Erivo, Katie Holmes and John Mulaney. A Deadly American Marriage is a Netflix documentary. It investigates the tragic death of Irishman Jason Corbett, who moved to North Carolina with his two children and married Molly Martins in 2008. 7 years later, Corbett was killed during a violent altercation with Molly and her father, Thomas. The documentary explores the complex dynamics of their marriage and a bitter custody battle over Corbett's children. With me in studio this evening, Chris Wasser and Jen Gannon. And let's start with Poker Face. If I can keep a straight face for 5 minutes while I talk about this. What do we need to know? I think we need to know certain things about season one.
Okay.
When season two kicks off, because they're not going to help you.
No, well, they do. They do a little bit of it previously on Poker Face at the, yeah, the very beginning.
You have no idea who any of those people are unless you've watched season one.
Well, Poker Face season one, it felt to me like this throwback to that kind of gorgeous golden-hued mystery of the week shows. Mm. Like Columbo, like your Quincy, and Natasha Lyonne was shuffling about as this reincarnated Columbo trying to get into his raincoat. And she accidentally is stumbling across murders in small towns, basically. So the premise is quite simple. So Charlie Cale, who's Natasha Lyonne, she has this gift. It's a sixth sense that she can always tell when someone's lying, and she kind of punctuates their lie with an expletive. Like, she has this truth-telling kind of Tourette's. And when we first meet her in season one, she is attempted to apply the gift to gambling. She wants to make her fortune through gambling. But after burning one shady person too many, she has to go on the run because she ends up working as a waitress in a local casino. Her best friend gets murdered and she ends up being chased by the mob.
Yeah, and that's kind of everywhere she goes, the mob are chasing her.
Exactly.
We see kind of maybe 5 minutes of them in the middle somewhere at the top and at the end. But that is the ongoing story. It's a bit like The Fugitive, I suppose, in that respect, Chris. You know, this idea of the guy who's going from town to town solving problems, but he's being chased in the process.
Yeah.
There's a touch of that. And then, like Jen says, back to good old-fashioned Sunday
it is
night television.
Yeah, sometimes it does. Not sometimes, all the time. It feels like a throwback to, you know, 1970s How Catchem's, not whodunits. And Rian Johnson has been very clever about the season two because he does give us a quick recap at the beginning for people like me who didn't even watch any of season one.
I had watched some of season one, but
this passed me by.
The recap helped you.
The recap helped me. I think the real test was I going to be able to make it through the first episode without, you know, checking my phone and seeing who's this character, what's going on. I didn't need to do that at all for 3 or 4 episodes. It explains itself well, but it also takes this really kind of fuss faff free approach to its storytelling where it's almost like there are times where you think Natasha's going to turn around and go, this will come to you. Don't worry about it right now. A little bit like her ability to, you know, be that human lie detector. We're not going to over explain things. Just go with it. And I think that's what I love about it.
All right. Well, I'm glad you said that this all came to you very easy because Cynthia Erivo was playing 4 different characters. Four sisters here. Let's hear her very early.
Could be five, could be six, could be more.
Let's hear her. This is quite close to the very beginning of the first episode, and this is we're in a big house. It's classic Columbo kind of stuff. We're in a big house. There's a woman in a bed, and she's talking to her daughter. And all we know at this stage is that the daughter has been looking after her as best she possibly can, but she's about to get a bit of a surprise.
What's that supposed to be?
It's us. I'm moving into portraiture. Have to branch out if I want to develop as an artist.
Artist?
Mm-hmm.
That's spangled garbage.
Artist.
You'll be the Gauguin of Etsy.
Well, I wouldn't expect you to understand, Mother.
Oh, no, but you do expect me to keel over, leave you my fortune, and bankroll your little artist journey.
Mother, don't be so morbid.
I see you. I see what you're doing. Oh, that faithful child. So selfless, caring for that mean old woman.
Can I get you anything else?
Four daughters, and the one I kept closest is my biggest disappointment.
Yes, well, my other sisters are not here, washing your foot rags, cutting your charcuterie, and making you delicious homemade soup.
It's ticket. Oh, good, Paul's here.
Lawyer Paul?
Yes, I have to get my affairs in order.
We already made your will. We did it together.
Oh, you're in for a surprise, Amber. That is Cynthia Erivo as Amber. She plays, I think, four sisters. You're possibly right, there may be more than four. Amber, BB, CC, and DD. And obviously the BB, CC, and DD are short versions of other names. I found that aspect of things a little bit confusing. I thought, all right, here's a daughter going to be disinherited. Things are not going to look good for the mother.
But don't worry about that too much, like Chris says, because the thing about
don't worry about being able to follow it. No,
you will, because the thing about Poker Face is it lays it all out for you at the beginning. This is not some complicated show like anxiety ridden where you're kind of going, I need to concentrate on every single aspect, because what you're seeing is the murder is the beginnings of it. So the way it's kind of reversed engineered, so it really starts with the murder, and then you get Charlie coming into the murder, and it's all about how she figures it out.
Yeah.
And the thing about Charlie is she's not a detective, she's not a policewoman, she's a regular Joe, and she's just striving that, you know, hoping that the truth will out somehow, and she's going to help them out to do that, to access that. So it makes it more like, yes, you can see it's kind of like there's strands of Columbo there, obviously, but also there's strands of, you know, Murder, She Wrote, because everywhere Charlie goes, there's a murder. But then also for me personally, I feel like with the Charlie Cale character, it's a bit like Highway to Heaven. It's a bit like The Littlest Hobo. Like, she's coming in as this almost spiritual road
right,
dog.
Right, there's a touch of that.
Zooming through life and attempting to, you know, hoping to realign the humanity of people, I think, at the end of the day.
I should have pointed out, by the way, that Jasmine Guy was the other character in that clip that we had there, playing the wonderfully named Norma Kaczynski. Even the names are straight out of the, you know, the Acme book of crime names or mother names or whatever names you're looking for.
Oh, Rian Johnson is not, like, he's a fan, right? Rian Johnson, who created this.
He's kind of praising these things.
Yeah, absolutely. He's a fan of everything from Columbo to The Incredible Hulk, and you can see those influences in here, and they work so well. And I like the fact that this follows a very straightforward formula in every single episode. You have this 15-minute setup where you're introduced to all of the characters except for Natasha. You have the murder cover-up. You have snooping around, and then you have Charity cracking the case. That's not spoiling anything. She always cracks the case. And still, you go back every week delighted to see who's going to be the next big guest star. Yeah. How's Charity going to solve this? You are at home looking out for the clues that Charity's looking out for.
And that was a part of the charm of something like Columbo as well, because Columbo had, you know, Faye Dunaway and Johnny Cash appearing like in its run. So you have, as you said, John Mulaney, Melanie Lynskey, Steve Buscemi, Gabby Hoffman, and Katie Holmes in a great turn. And it's so good to see her back on her screens. I think you forget how good she is.
Because the Cynthia Erivo character, and she plays a bundle of sisters, and she's having great fun, you know.
Everyone is having great crack on this
really
show. And
it,
that's such an important thing. It kind of comes off the screen, like it really does.
But she says towards the end of episode one, as one of the sisters, I can't remember which one, you know, we'd be a good team. We'd be a good team together.
Yeah.
Is she going to reappear?
No,
is that at the end of every episode? Everybody wants to be her partner.
There's always some sort of connection formed, even in the episode with Giancarlo Esposito, where he's playing he runs a funeral home with his wife, Katie Holmes. Katie Holmes says she's going to leave him, and then it doesn't end well for Katie Holmes. There's always some friendship made after Charity solves the murder, but you can't get too attached to these people because it's not about the guest stars. It is about Natasha.
Yeah. And it's like The Littlest Hobo.
Yeah,
that way.
Yeah,
everyone
exactly,
wants to keep The Littlest Hobo, but they have to keep on moving on.
Exactly. I think this role for her, she's brilliant in everything she does.
She
whether it's a film she made recently last year,
His Three Daughters
on Netflix.
Yeah,
which
she was super in that.
Terrific,
absolutely brilliant
terrific.
In that. Yeah.
Russian Doll, Orange is the New Black. But this, I think, is the role that she was just born for. And it's one where that, you know, that eccentric charm, that raspy voice that she has, it just, it suits this amateur sleuth down to the ground. She's fascinating to watch.
because it has this whole aesthetic to it as well, and she directs the episode with Katie Holmes.
Great director. All
right. And it has, it's a nod to like the 70s B-movie aesthetic, because it's a film being made in the 70s, like set in the 70s in this funeral home at the same time. And it's like, you know, it's like you're saying, Ryan Johnson is a fan, and it's for fans of stuff, like, as in, you've got mentions of like Dennis Hopper, you've got mentions of Sidney Lumet's Prince of the City.
Lots of Easter eggs.
It's appreciative of what cinema was, how great it was, and how great the golden age of TV was. And I really do think I'm enjoying this phase of Natasha Lyonne's career, because she's in her 40s creating these roles that are usually reserved for the solitary man. And she is the solitary woman without a man by her side, without any children. And she's just on the road.
I'm very interested to hear how many stars you're going to give. I have never heard you enthuse so much about a series and an actor.
I'm such a huge fan of her, and I do think she's just this great female vagabond presence, and I think she is this great kind of philosophical intellectual presence. So I'm going to give it a 5 out of 5. It's irresistible.
I guessed it might be Chris.
I should add that Jen was talking to me, because I knew that Jen was a fan of this from the very beginning, and talking about how it's probably better because it does hark back to the days when you used to not gobble up television, but wait a week and see what Columbo is going to do next. I think it actually does suit it better watching it one episode at a time. Don't binge the heck out of it. But I love this. I loved her. I love Ryan Johnson's writing. We'll go 4.5 out of 5.
4.5 out of 5. Okay. And it is available on Sky. Let us move on then to Netflix documentary about, I suppose, a subject that most people listening to will be familiar with, the violent death of Limerick man Jason Corbett, who was killed at his North Carolina home 10 years ago. Chris, this tells the story. I think a lot of people will be familiar with lots of the detail. But one of the most striking aspects of this is who participates in this documentary.
Yeah, so the documentary makers were able to interview both sides on this case. And what I mean by that is they were able to talk to Jason Corbett's family, so Tracy Corbett Lynch and her husband David Lynch.
Yeah, Tracy is Jason's sister,
and they are now the legal guardians of Jason's two children, Jack and Sarah. So they are, and Jack and Sarah as well are interviewed.
Who are now teenagers.
Yes, so they would have been around 8 and 10 when their father died, and they are now around 19 and 17 when they're being interviewed. But also, this documentary was 4 years in the making. So I think the interviews actually started when Jack was around 16. And then on the other side, so you had an interview team working in Ireland, and you also had an interview team working in the UK. And on the American side of things, you had the filmmaker sitting down with Molly Martins, who was married to Jason, and her father, Thomas Martins. And again, interviewed at various points because they, along the way, served prison sentences. So we're getting them before and then after their release in 2024.
And on appeal, the sentence was changed. Yes. Jen, getting the two sides of the story in that fashion, what does that do for the viewer? What does that allow the viewer do?
I mean, I suppose I think we have to be very conscious of the fact that as Irish viewers, we would, as you said, know the story very well. And I know the case obviously very well, and I think that is when you're broadening it out to the market for Netflix, you're broadening it out to the American market as well. So it does set it up for both sides to be put across. So it's kind of left the decision is yours in that way.
With true crime dramas.
And true crime as a genre is taking those, it's not a straight reading of a case file in that way. Mm. It's always going to be, you know, it has to work in a certain rubrics of almost like a thriller in that way. And that is the way it's kind of presented here.
I'll come back to the true crime aspect of it, because I think it is a very, not just of this documentary, but in general. But let's listen to a clip from quite early on. And this is Tracy, who you mentioned. This is Jason Corbett's sister. And this, she's very early on, she's telling us about how she heard about the death of her brother.
My brother got a call to say that Jason was dead. He and Molly had an argument. She pushed him, he fell, hit his head and died. So I immediately started to call Molly, and I got no answer at that time. I can't comprehend, I can't process. You know, I just couldn't believe it. Jason and I, we were super close. We had a really big family. We grew up in Janesborough in Limerick. And Jason and Wayne and myself are the three youngest. Jason remained a constant best friend. When I had learned the news, my first thought was to the welfare of Jack and Sarah. And so within hours, I'm packed and on the road to fly to America in order to find out what happened to Jason and to make sure Jack and Sarah are safe.
And that's Tracy Corbett Lynch there from the documentary Deadly American Marriage. One of the aspects of this that Jen touched on before we listened to that clip, Chris, is this idea of the true crime.
Yeah.
We often, you know, we've seen true crime dramas where we see American courtrooms and we hear American news reports. This, I wondered, how different is it because we are hearing Irish news reports? We're hearing programmes we're all familiar with. We're seeing broadcasters we are all familiar with on the screen giving us various details of the case as we go along. And we're seeing something about a man that we have come to know through this terrible story of his death. Does it change? What kind of ideas around a story so close to home being used as true crime documentary? What kind of ideas did that put in your head?
I know what you mean. It does make it that little bit more of a delicate subject matter because we've lived through this and we've been watching this play out in real time over the last 10 years. And I think when you hear that a true crime documentary is going to be made about Jason Corbett and his family, you're thinking, oh no, somebody's going to try and sensationalize this or exploit the matter. I don't think that's the case here. I think the filmmakers, Jenny Popplewell and Jessica Burgess, I think they have gone out of their way to, first of all, they're actually trying to give some sort of order and structure to a case that at times is just baffling. But I think also they're treating with respect so much because I think they're treating with a lot more respect than maybe I thought they would, because you think of these things, you think of Netflix true crime documentaries, you think they're going to do some sort of weird reconstruction. They're going to go a bit maybe over the top when it comes to the score. I don't think it's any of that. I think that the aim here is just to let the people involved tell the story.
Yeah.
And that's what they do.
But there's no getting away from the fact that, and I know there are those who would argue, yes, you should show the pictures of the crime scenes. You should show the pictures of what happened in that house on that night, or certainly the pictures that were taken after the event. Do we need to see all of this? Is it important that we see that kind of graphic detail on the screen? Because there's no point in denying it is very graphic.
It's grisly. It's gruesome. Yeah. It definitely is. And it's very effective, but in that way, because I do think, not in a sensationalist way, but I just think in a reality way, just to have those photos to say, look, this is the aftermath and this is what, you know, they saw when they arrived at this house. So I do think it's done in a way where, you know, especially when you have the interviews with the children, with Jack and Sarah, when they're talking about just the events around what happened to their father, how their feelings were, and it brings you back to the reality of the missing father in their life and a violent death. And I think that is important, because I think for them, having their voices heard like this and their story told on their terms is really important.
Yeah, and they keep expressing, both the two young teenagers, they both keep telling us, we want to tell. We want our story to be heard. We want people to hear what we want to say.
That's it. Yeah. There is a sense there with the Corbett and the Corbett Lynch family that, you know, they are trying to reclaim the narrative, that they want to tell this story. And that, again, like the filmmakers, they want to put some order on it. They want to put some structure on it. They want it to make sense for themselves and also for the viewers. I mean, you are always going to come away, unfortunately, with documentaries like this with some questions, maybe more questions than you had going in. But that's always the case. I think it's such a difficult subject to make a film about, but everyone involved has done the best that they can with what they have, I think.
Yeah, and it has to be said, every member of the Corbett family speaks so in such a dignified fashion.
About their life. I mean, and it's such a stark and emotional watch, I think. And it should be.
Yeah,
and I think, you know, their testimony, any footage with them is just so... It's respectfully done, and I think, you know, they should be proud of themselves for being able to do that, because, I mean, I think if anybody was in as difficult a situation as them, it's so hard to set yourself apart from that, to be able to tell
your
story.
I'm simply going to ask, would you recommend watching this documentary, Jen?
Yeah, I think, I mean, people in Ireland obviously have this vested interest in it, and I think they want to see from their point of view, you know, their story. So I think, it's relevant and important.
And Chris?
Oh, I think so, because there's been 1,001 news reports about this, but it is actually good that everything is in the one place. And I think if people are going to be talking about it, which they will be over the next few weeks, just make sure that you watch it first.
Mm. Yeah. Don't have an opinion on something you haven't watched. Exactly. That is a fair point. Chris won't stop some people, but nevertheless. A Deadly American Marriage is the title of the documentary we've been speaking about there. It's available on Netflix. And before that, we were talking about season 2 of Poker Face. Jen Gannon and Chris Wasser with me in studio. And so to our album reviews on this Friday evening, Louise Bruton and Owen Glacken, beg your pardon, Owen, had their headphones. They were in the shade. It was a little too warm to be sitting out in the sun listening today, I would have thought. What were they listening to? They were listening to The World That I Knew. And this comes from 11 musicians led by Lucy Escanaga and Consuelo Nerea Bershki, collectively known as Varo, are the two women, but they have songs here with these 11 musicians and songs written between 30 and 300 years ago. Do they speak to us in the present day? We shall find out later. Pioneering electronic musician and producer Mark Pritchard of The Smile and Radiohead frontman Tom York released their debut album. It's called Tall Tales. They're a double act now, York and Pritchard. They use AI in this album. And Counting Crows, the San Fran band that has made a permanent mark on the alternative rock scene since 1991, bring us a follow-up to their EP Butter Miracles, Butter Miracles Suite 1, The Complete Suites. Yeah, there you go. That's what we have in store for you over the next half hour or so. And let us start with Varo and The World I Knew. What they've done here, I was just going to go straight into a track, but what they've done here, I think, Louise, is noteworthy in terms of these two women and bringing together this huge variety of artists into this big album.
Yeah, it's an Excel sheet I would love to see. So during 2020, they got this idea to start a project to record songs from 30 to 300 years ago that can somehow tie in to the present kind of chaos and turmoil and everything.
They're looking for connections to today.
Yeah, and so many of the songs, there's quite a few songs that could have been written like in this century, but they belong to the 19th century, dealing with racism, dealing with emigration, dealing with the leisure classes and the wealth divide, everything, every issue that we are reading in the newspapers today, they are dealing with in these songs. Particularly there's one that I think that is an excellent kind of example of how music can transcend time is Work Life Out to Keep Life In. It's all about not having enough time to live your life.
We all know that one. Sweet Liberty has a rather more serious topic to it, or theme to it, I think, Owen. Let's have a listen to it. Okay. We can talk about it afterwards.
Cool.
And like every other track, it features somebody well known from the current raft of traditional Irish musicians. Sweet Liberty features Ian Lynch. And that is Sweet Liberty from Varo, from their album The World That I Knew. And Sweet Liberty features the voice there of Ian Lynch. And in fact, Owen Glacken, as we're listening to it, it features a lot of the Lancome music style really within it there, doesn't it?
Sure.
Outside of those harmonies up above the drone underneath.
Yeah, they kind of own the drone at this stage, don't they?
You
hear drone and you sort of think Lancome and in a good way. That song, I that was maybe my highlight of the whole album, and there's a lot of highlights for me.
Where does it come from originally, that song?
It's written by a guy, John Scheel, and it was written sometime in the 1800s. I'm not sure if that exact date is known. I don't know it anyway. But the anti-racist message is very blatant in it, and it, just there, I think just before the song cut off, there's lyrics about how the Turkey is me fellow man, the Jew, the same indeed, sir. To the infidel, I'd raise my hand and help him in his need, sir. And later on, he talks about how the earth is all one family. I mean, Ian Lynch delivers it like it was written yesterday. It was, of course, not. It was written a long time ago, and it's just so prescient. And that's what's beautiful about the album, and that's what's great about folk music, is when people recontextualise old songs and they bring them up to date and they kind of smack you in the face with how relevant all of these issues still are. And you can kind of think of people 100 years ago as being almost alien. You know, 200 years ago, who were they? You know, totally different people dealing with the same stuff. here we are, we have computers and technology, but we're still dealing with the same issues. And that's what this album kind of draws out really beautifully.
And there are lots of, you know, there are lots of them are dark issues, unfortunately, that we're dealing with in this, Louise. But there's something about it, and we heard it particularly there in Sweet Liberty, just as I was fading, when those harmonies, which Varro, that's what I associate with Varro, those wonderful harmonies that they have together, when they come in, it kind of, even though it's a very serious song, it lifts it into a brighter place.
Yeah, the great thing that they've done here is that they have orchestrated a theme and a sound, and they are the spine of every single song.
Yeah.
Where they are present either doing backing vocals, lead vocals, or on the fiddle, which they both play. And also Consuela is the daughter of the Italian musician Antonio Breschi, whose music is said to have inspired Riverdance. Oh. So this music, even though she is not Irish born, Irish music is very much in her blood. It's in her daily life. And there's one song that does display the two Varro members very clearly as
and
well.
And Lucy is originally from France.
Yes. So it's amazing that this
they came here for the music, I believe.
That has spoken so much to them, and they've managed to wrangle the best names in folk and trad music in Ireland together and sing. But they have a song called Heather on the Moor, which might be better known to Paul Brady fans. But they have singer Innie Kay and then the bouzouki player Libby McCrohan. And it's a very effeminate ballad sung about a soldier falling in love with a shepherdess. And it just brings that little bit of light that we don't necessarily find when there's a drone going on in the background.
Yeah, I'm going to play a second track, Skibbereen. And this goes back to the Irish famine, the story of this song. So hardly... Not the brightest of tales, Louise.
No, so this is traced back to 1869, and it's about a father telling his son about the Irish famine, being evicted from their home, and then the needing to flee as a result of the Young Ireland Rebellion of 1848. So lots going on.
A lot going on, and it features the voice of Junior Brother, among others.
I left home, Skibbereen.
Skibbereen, the title of that track from Varro and the new album, The World That I Knew. It is a kind of a sit back and listen, and they're long songs and you have to give them time and space. I think it's safe to say, Owen, as you sum up and give us stars.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, sometimes for me with modern sort of trad and folk, I do miss the kind of crack and the bit of fun and the light to it because it's a lot of shade. But here, I just didn't find myself thinking that at all. It's contextualizing all these old issues and bringing them to the fore again. That song, Skibbereen, about people being displaced against their will, how relevant today. For me, it's 4 stars out of 5.
And Louise?
Yeah, I'd be echoing Owen there with 4 stars. I think it's a real tremendous collection, meeting of minds and creativity.
All right, Varro, The World That I Knew, double 4 stars there, 4 out of 5, that is, from both Louise and Owen. Let's move on to album number 2. Radiohead and Smile frontman Tom York started to share work online with musician and producer Mark Pritchard beginning some 9 years ago. Let's listen to a track called Back in the Game. I guess that's not a real tuba. I'm guessing it's electronically produced there. Mark Pritchard, rather, and Tom York at an album called Tall Tales. And there we had a track called Back in the Game. I suppose we all know Tom York, or at least we can place him. Mark Pritchard, is he as easy to place, Louise?
Mark Pritchard is more of a background man, but he would have been very involved in the 90s electronic music scene, dabbling in breakbeat, trip-hop, drum and bass, all of the deep and dirty electronic music that would have, you know, been a very big part of the kind of rave scene in the UK. He's now based in Sydney, and how him and Tom York got to work on this album is they had previously worked together on Mark's 2016 album, and Mark had also remixed Bloom from Radiohead's 2011 album. But during COVID, Mark just kind of had this idea of like, oh, maybe I'll send some songs to Tom, good old Tom, and see what happens. And then Tom, funny enough, reached out to him. And between the UK and Australia during COVID, they were just sending demos back to each other.
Yeah.
And Mark dived into his huge archive of synthesizers and digital effects to come up with very unusual sounds. A lot of the time he's experimenting with Tom York's voice to the point where he sounds like a different gender, a different age, a different even a different mood, because he's not often a cheery guy.
We were saying as we were listening to that, on that was perilously close to a pop song.
That's
and it's probably as near as we get on this album, is it? It
certainly is, yeah. And I kind of love that artistic restraint to do that, to not,
and is
to
that
not
part
let
of
it slip into something resembling a pop song, but you can, the parts are in there. Just
I would
waiting
be snobby
to be
now
out.
Saying that. I would be snobby saying that.
Well, I think we're, it? Yeah, well, you know.
It's not allowed to be a pop song.
It can absolutely be a pop banger, but just it would have been a bit strange on this album.
Well, it would have been just strange to hear Tom York doing it. But there's something done to his voice there, because it does sound brighter and lighter.
Yeah, I mean, apparently there's AI in play in this album, in the making, all this sort of stuff. But the vocal to me, I put it this way, this morning I woke up and I was delighted that the album is officially released, because we were listening to kind of an advanced stream during the week, because we're all very important. And I was delighted because I could go on, because when an album's out, all of a sudden the lyrics are up on the internet, so I could go through and read them, and there's some brilliant lines in there, some brilliant lyrics. There's a song Bugging Out Again, and it's like these seven really tidy quatrain verses, and they're, you know, he's lyrically on form, but you just can't really hear it.
Yeah, sometimes the lyrics are kind of mixed down, or, you know, quite far back in the mix, or so much a part of the mix that it's just almost like another instrument. Is there a message in this album, or is there a theme going across the songs, Louise?
I don't think there's anything subliminal or clearly going on, but it's a little bit of stream of consciousness. But there is a paranoia that runs through a lot of the album. It's very dark, it's very dystopian. And then on that track, there was a digital harmonizer that was used on Tom York's voice to really bring him down to a much lower voice than we're used to. So there is actually, if anyone's on Apple Music, they do a track by track breakdown of what technologies Mark Pritchard
used. Is that really for the anorexics in this area, or is it help to actually understand the music?
I'm sure some people will have a field day with it, but for any others, we're like, oh, another synth, is it? But it is, there's a lot of genres. There's one song called Happy Days, and there's a bit of polka, a bit of bossa nova in there for people who want
a jaunty sea shanty again.
It's a jaunty sea shanty.
The darkest one you've ever heard.
But probably another one of their, there's another song on it called The Spirit, which sounds a little bit like the it's that kind of hopeful 70s rock.
Well, let's have a listen to a little bit of a track called Gangsters. Fully decide whether it's a video game from the 1980s or whether it's a checkout in one of the supermarkets around town.
Neither of those are particularly positive images you're conjuring.
Well, depends. Well, depends.
It does depend, I suppose.
I suppose. Anyway, did it work overall for you, this one, Owen?
Yeah, I was really, really blown away by it. I kind of went in thinking, oh, is it going to be inaccessibly experimental? But of course it's not. And they get that balance between tangible, real, earthy songwriting and then just going off in these weird places. And I mean, that song, Tall Tales, the title track, it genuinely creeped me out to the point where I still feel it. And for me, anyway, it's 4.5 out of 5 for me.
4.5?
I've
had a good week. Yeah. Louise?
It's 4 for me. It's sonically probably not as experimental as they wanted to be, but the production of it is.
Right.
So something for people who like that.
And
sort of
a little bit of AI, are we thumbs up or something?
Well, they are releasing a feature film to go along with this, and the visuals that are going with this, with the album, they are done with CGI and AI, but licensed AI or something like that. But yeah, a bit dodgy also.
So 4 and 4.5, is that what we got?
4 for me.
4 from Louise, 4.5 from Owen. Let's move on then to Counting Crows. American's alternative rock band have announced a gig in Dublin's Three Arena on October the 21st as part of their tour to promote the Complete Suites album. And do you want to decide whether to go to it or not? Well, here's a track that might help you. There we go. Spaceman in Tulsa, one of the tracks from Counting Crows and their new album, Butter Miracle, The Complete Suites. I suppose people would think of Mr. Jones, I think that's what they'll think of when they think of Counting Crows. And are we, on the basis of that track, are we in a similar happy, clappy, upbeat type of place?
I think Counting Crows probably have about 3 strains to them. There's the Mr. Jones happy, clappy gets stuck in your head for if whether you love it or hate it. And they have the piano ballad that somehow always references an American town. And we've a lot of American towns referenced here.
Well, Tulsa we had there, obviously.
Tulsa, and there's Virginia Through the Rain. And yeah, it's they're Counting Crows have not changed, and that is something that's probably to their credit and to a lot of people's dismay. But they're a band that is consistent. They've more or less had the same members for the past 30 years, which not a lot of bands can say that.
Yeah.
And this is only their eighth album, so they're obviously not wearing each other down into the ground.
And are they reinventing the wheel in the eighth album, or are they giving us more of what they've been giving us over the last seven?
Well, they gave me what I came looking for. I was genuine. When that sort of lazy stoner blues swing from the opening track of the, With Love from AZ, I immediately just thought, well,
I'm in.
I missed this band. And then as soon as Adam Duritz's voice came in, I thought, wow,
I missed this band.
And I thought the songs were great. I thought they're brilliantly delivered. Adam Duritz's lyrics, you're talking there about how every song is about a town or whatever, and you're absolutely correct, but I think that's a brilliant technique that he uses, where he drops the listener into a physical location, and it's sort of, and like there's a song on the tall grass, and as he's describing his physical surroundings, you're there with him sort of exploring it and revealing it as it happens, and it gets me.
I ask you then, listener, come with us and be on and into through the magic door. Grass.
Eyes are open wide, staring up at me in infinity in the shrinking English sky.
There you go. To be fair, you're right, Owen. He does kind of bring you with him into the tall grass. There's a kind of a theatrical aspect to what he's doing there.
Yeah, and that's kind of throughout that sort of rock opera almost influence, the Jim Steinman, Springsteen sort of thing. And the closing track in particular, Bobby and the Rat Kings, is straight out of the sort of pre-Born to Run era Springsteen, sort of Jungleland light.
Right.
I don't know, it's just great. It's really uplifting, fun, positive music. It's great.
Perfect for a sunny afternoon.
It's perfect for a sunny
in the middle
afternoon.
Of May.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah, so which is what you're suggesting. I'm guessing this is a high star rating again from you, Owen?
It's a good clean four for me.
A good clean four. And what class of a whatever number you're going to give are you giving, Louise?
It's a lukewarm three for me, and like fair play to them, but there is quite a lot of Boomtown Rats knockoff songs.
Oh
here,
yeah, the piano was in the Tulsa song that he's the boot.
That
really
and also
Boomtown
Bobby
Rats.
And the Rat Kings is a name of the song.
Yeah, it's a kind
so
of a,
yeah,
it's
a
little
nod
to say the very least, isn't it? Yeah. So what did you say?
Three for me.
Three for you, okay. And you were a good clean four.
I was a good wholesome clean four.
A good wholesome clean four. That's for Butter Miracle, The Complete Sweets. You need to shorten the title of the album, lads, might I suggest, to Counting Crows. Tall Tales, previous to that, for Mark Pritchard and Tom York. And The World That I Knew from Varro. Those were our three albums. By the way, Kevin Barry and Aaron Monaghan will be with us on Monday to tell us about Kevin's new play, which is called The Cave, opening at the Abbey Theatre in June. Aaron Monaghan is in the cast, as is Judith Roddy and Tommy Tiernan. We'll be hearing all about that, and Rebecca Solnit also talking to us about her new collection of essays. That's on Monday's Arena. But that is our lot for tonight and for this week. Liam Mullen was the on sound this evening. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Paula Shields research. And the programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Back with you on Monday at 7 o'clock here on RTE Radio 1. And Ray Cuddihy will be with you after the news.